This is Barry Tyker. It's February 8th, 1990. I'm in the home of Mrs. Gertrude Wilson for a continuation of the interview that started last month. December of 1989 is when we had our first interview. We're going to begin today by talking about certainly one of the most interesting figures in the history of the university, William Ellery Leonard. Now, you knew Mr. Leonard personally.
Very well. Yeah. He was a next-door neighbor of us from 1911 until for a good many years. He came to the University of Wisconsin in 1906. He was then 30 years old. He was born in 1876, January 25th, and died May 2nd, 1944. He'd been a student at Harvard, and subsequently went to Europe, to Germany, and did advanced work for an advanced degree there. He was the son of a Unitarian minister, born in Plainfield, New Jersey, and he was named for the eminent Unitarian minister, William Ellery Channing. That's how William Ellery Leonard, how he got the William Ellery. Now, we came to know him personally after the death of his first wife. He came to Madison in 1906 and had a room with Professor Freeman, who lived on Langdon Street and at the bend in the where Langdon Street bends there. Professor Freeman had a daughter, Charlotte, and I think another daughter who was all right, but Professor Leonard was never told that there was insanity in the Freeman family. When he married Charlotte Freeman, signs of mental instability showed. And she committed suicide subsequently, probably around 1910 or 11. It was at that time that he moved into the home of Professor Charles Forster Smith, our next-door neighbor. We became fast friends from then on. And I was personally a great friend of his until his death.
Now, when he moved in with Professor Smith, how did he know Professor Smith? What was their relationship?
You see, Professor Leonard was not only a great scholar in English, but he was a classicist as well. And Professor Smith was professor of Latin and Greek. So they became acquainted through that interest, and also, well, it was natural. Professor Leonard was not only a great professor, a wonderful professor of English, he was a gifted poet. And then he became, I don't know whether you want to put this in or not, he fell in love with my older sister, Helen. In 1911, I was 13 years old. Helen was 15. Ellery was 35. Mother was distraught. And where we ever got the money, I don't know, but she sent Helen to Hillside School in Spring Green, the Frank Lloyd Wright school, which was run by Frank Lloyd Wright's maiden aunts. It was a wonderful school. It was a private school, coeducational, took people from all over the country, a number of Mexicans. And Helen was there. Philip, my brother Philip, who was the oldest of mother's five children, was frantic but could do nothing because he was in Alaska. Except that he wrote to Dean Burge and told Dean Burge to tell Ellery to lay off Helen.
Did Dean Burge tell him?
He did. there was somewhat of a coolness between my brother Philip and Ellery Leonard. However, Ellery Leonard married somebody else for his second wife. So
so the reason your sister was sent was specifically to get him out of
Yes, because he wrote and produced this play, and my sister Helen was Oakleaf.
Okay, let's talk about the play for a moment. It's called Glory of the Morning. I have
Glory
a
of the Morning,
copy of it right in front
and
of
it's an Indian girl. My eyesight is too poor to reread it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was played downtown at the Fuller Opera House, which was the theater in Madison. It was on Main Street between Wisconsin Avenue and the beginning of State Street in that block.
Mm-hmm.
It later was taken over and called the Parkway Theater.
Mm-hmm.
Then later on after that in the Parkway closed, Barron's Store was there. Anyway, that was a gala evening. Mother and my sister Margaret and I went to the performance, and the producers or the potentates came down and greeted us, and we stood up, and I was only, you see, what was I, about 13 years old when that was produced. Of course, Ellery chose Helen because he was crazy over her, and Helen naturally was very flattered. So
how did the play come up?
Beautifully. The play is dedicated to Thomas H. Dickinson. Thomas H. Dickinson very prominent in what was then called the Wisconsin Dramatic Society. And I think the Wisconsin Dramatic Society was really the origin of what we now call the Wisconsin Theater.
Mm-hmm.
You see, it says on there, I think, Wisconsin, yes, doesn't
it
say?
Wisconsin Dramatic Society,
yes,
in Madison.
And it's dedicated to Thomas H. Dickinson.
Okay. Was it critically acclaimed? Do you remember what the press said about the play?
I can't tell you that far back, but it was very well received. I have a copy, which I will lend to you, because I don't want to give this up. But this is Two Lives. You can open it and see what he says there. And what does he say there? To what?
To Margaret Hamilton.
Margaret Knowlton.
Knowlton and Helen and Gertrude.
That's me.
Long years ago, the three little sisters from across the hall.
Over the hill.
From over?
It should be over the hill.
Looks like across. Oh, well, over the hill. From always their affectionate friend, William Ellery Leonard Madison, November 8, 1925.
Yes. Well, the three little sisters are over the hill, are in toward the end of that. Now, I have another copy of that, which I think is a great poem. If you would like to borrow it.
Sure, I'd love to.
That,
so the three little sisters are you.
Yes.
Are the three of you.
Yes.
Oh, well, that's very interesting. I've never known that. And this is published in, copyrighted in 1922.
By
and
Hibsch,
in 25.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
H-U-E-B-S-C-H.
Well, who's Hibsch? I've never heard of that.
I think they were New York. And isn't there somewhere in here, where's the other book?
The other book is called The
Vaunt of Man.
Vaunt of Man,
isn't there something in the front of that?
There. Gertrude Wilson, given to her sister Margaret by the author.
Yes. And okay. Here.
1912.
Now this is, doesn't it say here, I've set no stone upon the grave out there.
I've set no stone upon the grave out there.
That's his first wife.
Whither in all my years I shall not go. But conquering pain and pity and despair, I bind these leaves with solemn hands and slow. My poems, all my sacred best of life, be yours forever, O my wife, my wife.
It's perfectly wonderful book.
Dedicated to the first wife who committed suicide.
Then he had a very stormy, emotional life. His second wife was Charlotte Charlton. That lasted for a good many years. But evidently he needed the devotion of more than one woman. So Fortunately for our friendship, there was never anything of that in our friendship. And that's why it lasted so long and was so good. His second wife and he were divorced. Then he married a Grace Golden, who was after his fame rather than interested in him. That was ended in divorce, and he remarried his second wife.
Oh, I guess I didn't know that.
Yes, he remarried Charlotte Charlton, and they that went much better than the first time he married her. So he finally died in 1944.
Was he still married to...
I think he was still married to Todd. He called her Todd. She was always called Todd, T-O-D. Hmm. And...
Why Todd? Isn't that German for death?
Das Tod. Tod und das Mädchen is death in the...
My German is rusty.
That's... and this... Now, this is my copy, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
But isn't there one on the stairway there? Isn't there another one there?
Yeah, there are two. Two Lives and the Son of Earth.
Well, you may borrow
Two Lives
if you want to.
Yeah, I would like to look at that.
This we'll put it back here. Well, he did a translation of Lucretius. All the stuff he did, the books that he did are upstairs in the study.
Now, as a scholar, what was his main contribution to the university as a scholar?
Oh, it was so great, it's unbelievable. It covered so many fields. Warren Moon says that his rendition of Gilgamesh is the best there is.
So he did a lot of translating?
Oh, yes, and he did Lucretius, and he was a tremendous scholar.
Yeah, how was he?
Egyptologist.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I didn't know that.
And when he was in Germany, I think there was a great Egyptologist by the name of von Ranke. Whether Ellery actually studied under him or a son of von Ranke, I don't know. But I know that he was a great scholar in the humanities as well as English.
How was he as a teacher?
Marvelous as a teacher, perfectly wonderful. Toward the end of his teaching career, he was terribly hampered because of the phobia which really governed his physical life. So finally, his area of being able to walk and ride a bicycle narrowed, became increasingly small.
Now, we had mentioned, talked about that before, but let's go talk about the origins of that, because you were on a bike ride with him.
Yes.
But before we even do that, you developed a friendship with Leonard. How did that start, and how did that develop over the years?
Those letters that I have showed, after I was married in 1923, I lived in Philadelphia from 1923 until 1927 with my husband, and my daughter was born there. We left Philadelphia and came to Milwaukee and lived in Milwaukee until 1932, when I came back to Madison with my daughter, without my husband. And Ellery used to write to me in Milwaukee. One of those letters is there. Oh, the card. Isn't there a card there?
No, isn't just some letters.
Yes, there's a card here somewhere. Well, then it's inside the book. Let's see if there isn't a...
There's a card here, but that's just a marker.
Well, it's somewhere there, because I saw it yesterday.
Oh, here. This...
No, that isn't it. Here.
Oh, there it is.
That postcard, I think, is directed to me in Milwaukee. Would you look and see?
Mrs. Lewis K. Wilson?
Yes.
Oh, Newberry Boulevard.
Yes.
Milwaukee, Wisconsin, yes. Dear Gertrude, we've been hoping for
That's
so
when
long
he was living at 433 North Murray Street.
Oh, here in Madison. Yeah, yes. 433 North Murray Street. Postmarked August 13, 1930. We've been hoping so long to see you. Aren't we going to soon? A little visit would do you and yours good too. Anyway, tell me how you got on. Meanwhile, this picture of the old swimming hole to make you homesick. With love, yeah, and he initials it. It's signed August 12, 1930. And a picture on the front is an old swimming hole, which must be somewhere in Madison.
Oh, it's right down by the Willows.
Oh, yeah, the Willows, University of Wisconsin there.
Now, what's this?
Now, that's a picture.
That's a picture of him.
Of Leonard, yeah.
Yes.
With a kind of a bow tie that looks like it's been tied. I'm not quite familiar with that kind of tie. It's not really a bow tie as we know it.
No, it's a kind of almost a scarf.
Almost a scarf, yeah. Sort of somewhere between a bow tie and an ascot,
now,
I think.
My bed isn't made upstairs, but if you want to, if you can forgive that, we'll go. Well, all I can say about the friendship is that it was a great thing in my life and my mother, because at that time I was living, my mother was living with me and my daughter, and Ellery never made any decision without consulting me. That doesn't mean he always followed my advice. He seldom did, because I knew he wasn't going to. But when he got into trouble, he would call me. And I'd get him over the trouble. I said, now, you're alive and you're well, and you've got a lot to be thankful for. And you can always call me whenever you want to. if that's any comfort. I'm sure it was a comfort, because I was the one person who stuck by him through his stormy, on-again, off-again marriages. Because I had no axe to grind. Mm-hmm. I wasn't interested in him emotionally. He was also devoted to my mother. And that was very nice, very. So and to my daughter, Jill. And so he was a family friend as well as a personal friend.
Now, what about, we were upstairs just a moment ago looking at some of his inscriptions to you. Tell me a little bit about his sense of humor.
I wouldn't say he had much.
There seemed to be a little bit of whimsy in some of those.
Yes, there is, but I never would associate a sense of humor with Ellery.
Okay.
Never. He was a serious New Englander, a scholar. But somehow I don't think humor was part of his. Cynicism may have been, but that's not humor.
No, it isn't.
They're two different things.
Now let's talk a little bit about his developing phobias.
I remember just as well as if it was yesterday. The railroad tracks, if they're still there, there used to be railroad tracks, just west on University Avenue, just beyond what used to be the old Forest Products Laboratory building, part of the engineering school, down here.
Mm-hmm.
Are the railroad tracks?
I don't think so.
And there was a little red house there, and Ellery and I were riding his bicycle, and I had mine. I was then about 14 years old. And he got off his bicycle and said, Gertrude, I can't cross that track. Well, I said, of course, what's the matter? He said, I can't cross that track. You'll have to stay here with me. I said, I can't stay here. I can't stay here with you. Of course, then I called him Professor Leonard. I can't stay here with you. I've got to get home. Of course, we were living in the house I was born in. He did get across the track, but I remember how he was shaking from head to foot. That was the onset, at least as far as my experience with him was concerned.
It got worse over time.
It became worse and worse, so that his narrowed his sphere of activity. Fortunately, he lived at for many years in either the second or third floor at 433 North Murray Street. I don't know whether that house is still there or not.
Probably not.
Across from the University Club.
Well, it might be.
The side entrance of the University Club.
Is that where Helen C. White lived?
Yes.
Yes, it's still there.
Yeah, he lived at 433 North Murray. And finally, he had to stop going up the hill, up to Bascom Hall, which we incidentally used to be called Main Hall. Mm-hmm. And finally, the classes came to him, all his classes came to him, to his apartment, to his flat. It was a flat, not an apartment. There's a difference. Yeah. Do you know?
Yes.
A flat, you know, is the whole floor.
Right. Apartment is just a second.
It's just the part of the floor.
So you could get pretty much a whole class in there.
Yes.
And the class accepted that as.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Did you ever talk to him about, did he ever wonder why?
Yes, he published a book called The Locomotive God. Do you know that book?
I've heard of it, but I
Well, that
it.
Is, he wrote it, and it, hoping it was, explain his phobia. Hmm. I don't think that, I'm not a psychologist, mm-hmm. I'm not a neurologist, but he tries to explain it in that book, The Locomotive God.
And does he do so in psychological terms, or?
Somewhat, yeah. Yes. He was under the care of Dr. Lorenz here in Madison for a while, who was a pioneer in the field of that type of illness, and also founded and had as his private sanitarium what is now Oakwood, not Lutheran, mm-hmm. Center out here on Mineral Point Road.
But he never talked to you directly about the phobia.
Yes, he did. And but you see, he was born in 1876. I was born in 1898. So you see, he was 22 years, isn't that 22?
Mm-hmm.
22 years older than I. And he talked to me and I talked to him, and many people in Madison thought that he capitalized on the phobia. I never thought so, and I don't think he did. I think it was so deeply entrenched that during my friendship with him, that was not a part of it at all. It was something he could not handle, mm-hmm. simply couldn't.
So
he had a sister who was, whether she ever came out here or not, I don't know, but his parents did come out, and they, for a while, kept house for him in the little house which my mother at that time owned. I don't know how he happened to ever own a house other than the one I was born in, on the corner of Prospect Avenue and North Prospect and Chadburn. The northwest corner. The house is still there. And it wasn't a happy arrangement. His parents were not happy here, and he wasn't happy with them. So they didn't stay long.
This question may sound like it doesn't make much sense, but despite the phobia, was he able to live a fairly normal life?
Yes.
He could work around that okay?
Yes, he lived and published. He remained a scholar in spite of that.
So this didn't affect his scholarship at all?
No, but it was a dreadful thing,
mm-hmm.
a dreadful handicap, because anything of that sort that one cannot control, that masters one, you're no longer your own master. I'm not captain of my fate and master of my soul, or however it goes, you no longer are. And it was, I don't know what caused it, of course. It might have been dated way, way back in his childhood, probably somewhere. His parents were not his intellectual equal.
Oh, they weren't?
No. And that's a sad thing, too, because there isn't the sharing between parents and son.
And you had that extensive training in Europe as well.
Yes.
Which is, I think you said last time, where everyone around that time period went.
Everybody. Germany. Germany was the great center of learning in the late 1800s.
How was he among his peers in the English department?
Well, his students were crazy about him, and I think he was appreciated intellectually by everybody. Dean Sellery and he didn't get along, but a lot of people didn't get along with Dean Sellery.
Why didn't he and Dean Sellery get along?
Because Dean Sellery was difficult.
Why was he difficult?
Well, he was, I thought, terribly narrow-minded person. He was, he and Ellery didn't get along, and he was rigid in his ideas of morality. Now, I'm not loose, but...
So it was all in relation to...
It was in relation to Ellery's emotional interests in women.
Uh-huh.
Dean Sellery did appreciate his scholarship, of course,
uh-huh,
and what his contribution to the university. But Dean Burge and Ellery got along beautifully. But Dean Burge was a different person from Dean Sellery.
Yeah. What about President Frank, for example? Did he know Ellery Leonard at all?
I don't think so.
Any other figures on campus who William Ellery Leonard... knew that you could comment on?
No, I don't think I can tell you that. But he was very, very highly thought of.
Did he know Helen C. White? Was Helen C. White living in that building at the time that he was?
I don't think she was living there then. I don't think so. I don't think she was there then.
Let me just turn this off and fast forward.
Subsequently went to Harvard.
Okay, we're just finishing up on John Goss. And then there's a Harold G.R.O., is that Groves?
Harold Groves.
Yeah, okay.
Harold Groves was professor of taxation and a member of the group of John R. Commons, Harold Groves, Paul Rauschenbusch, Philip La Follette, Elizabeth Brandeis, Rauschenbusch, that whole group. Now I've got a picture of that somewhere in that desk. I'll show you when I can get at it.
What group was this? What did they do?
Well, they were.
What united them as a
well,
group?
E.B., that's what we always called her. She was a member of our Friday lunch group, Elizabeth Brandeis.
Yeah, Brandeis.
E.B. was labor relations and especially interested in migrant labor.
Mm-hmm.
They were instrumental, that group was, in the signing of the first, or producing the first unemployment insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Act of Wisconsin, and that I have a picture of them at the signing of it, of that whole group.
Now, was it sort of an informal?
And they were socially interested in each other.
Oh, it was not only.
It wasn't just in the university.
Oh
no, it was a
group.
It was a group that, well, John R. Commons wasn't a social person. He was socially, he wasn't interested in anybody.
We go down to M-Y-E-R, goodness gracious, let's skip that one, I'll figure it out. Holfeld.
Oh, Professor Holfeld. He was in the German department, lived over here on Breeze Terrace.
And he was there during World War One?
Yes, he was.
How did he fare during the
The whole German department was fared poorly. They were very unhappy.
And their enrollment dropped significantly, did it not?
Pardon me?
Their enrollment dropped significantly in the
department? I don't know about that, but probably it probably did. But it was a very hard time for them. That was the age of innocence disappeared in the university with the First World War.
Yeah, you've mentioned that before. I think you're probably right. Now, right next to Holfeld is another ex-member of the German department turned dean of men, Scott Goodnight.
Oh, was he originally?
Yeah,
in the
he was originally an instructor in the German department, I think, in 1913.
Well, Goodnight, of course, nobody will ever who knows anything about the past history associates him with sitting outside of Ellery's apartment all night, hoping to see a lady.
In front of William Ellery Leonard's?
Yes.
Oh,
didn't you know that?
Well, I've heard about the rocking chair incident.
Well, that
but I
is
thought
it.
That was some
That's
students.
It. Oh, oh no. Oh.
Well, tell me about it.
Well, Dean Goodnight was on on Ellery's trail. And he decided that he was going to prove that Ellery was having an affair. This isn't on, is
well,
it?
I can turn it off.
But he stayed there all night. And that was the rocking chair incident.
And the woman never came out the front door.
Well, he never met her. He never saw her.
Did Ellery know that Goodnight was on his trail?
Oh, yes. He didn't care. He was totally independent.
How did other people on the campus view Goodnight?
I don't think they thought very much of him.
I know the students were always trying to figure out ways to...
I don't think that Dean Goodnight was... as Dean of Men, I don't think he had the stature that Dean Matthews did as Dean of Women, before she married Judge Rosenberry. She was a strong person.
Now you say before she married Judge Rosenberry, did she
change? She was Dean Matthews, Dean of Women,
then
at the university.
Right.
And then she married Marvin Rosenberry, Judge Rosenberry. She was a strong person, a strong character, very, very much of a... She was no figurehead, but I don't think that Dean Goodnight ever had her stature.
Did Matthews and Goodnight know each other as far as...
Oh, they must have.
How, if you can do this, I don't know if you can, but how would you characterize the way Dean Matthews would handle discipline as opposed to the way Dean Goodnight would?
Oh, you mean in...
With the students, in relation to the students.
Well, I think Dean Matthews was very rigid, but I think she was also very fair. She was demanding, but fair, and highly respected. I don't think that Dean Goodnight ever was.
Ever. Was what, respected?
I don't think he was highly respected. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he was very greatly highly thought of, but she was.
So it's, without putting words in your mouth, it's sort of a matter of presence.
I think so. It's a matter of character and personality. When our great friend, who was also a member of Friday Lunch, Dean Troxell, was Dean of Women, I never thought Dean Troxell, Louise Troxell, was a very good dean of women. She wanted to be loved by everybody. Well, you know, you can't be. I mean, you just can't. If you are a good, strong administrator, you can't be loved by everybody. You just can't. And she wanted to be popular. I don't think Louise Troxell was ever much of a dean of women.
What about Dean Narden, who was the one between the two of them?
Well, I think she was kind of a non-entity.
It's interesting that the university chose Matthews, who, from all accounts that I've heard, was the strongest of the women deans before World War II.
Yes.
First, and then subsequently chose Narden.
And she was as I say, more or less of a nonentity. And then I think Louise Troxell followed.
Yeah, Louise Troxell followed. And she was there for quite a while.
Oh, she was there 25 years.
And so was Goodnight, I believe.
He was there forever.
How did faculty members relate to Goodnight? What did they say?
I don't know. They said he was. I don't think that they. He wasn't the kind of person that produced strong feelings, because he wasn't a personality that entitled one to have strong feelings about him.
Now, one other person associated with this group, and I think we might have mentioned him before, I'm not sure, is Joe Hammersley.
I don't know Joe
Hammersley. You don't know Joe?
You don't mean the...
The police officer.
Oh, yes! Hammersley ended up, poor Hammersley ended up drunk and died in the creek.
Died in the creek?
He fell, drowned in the creek?
No, I didn't know.
Joe Hammersley, the police officer, I didn't know. Oh, yes. You know where the road, do you know where the poultry research building is?
Yeah.
Well, there used to be beyond that, west of that, before you get to the wharf building, of a creek.
There still is a little one.
Yes.
A tiny one.
Well, that's where Joe Hammersley died.
He just fell over drunk?
Well, he was drunk. He fell and drowned.
Oh,
but he was a strong police officer.
I think we might.
Joe Hammersley, I can tell you, people knew who he was. He was no Scott Goodnight.
What did people say about Joe?
I think they liked him.
I've heard everybody has a Joe Hammersley story.
Yes.
At least one.
Well, I think they liked him because he was a strong character. You either like or dislike a person who is a very strong personality.
Yeah. So as opposed to Scott Goodnight, who was sort of neutral, you had Joe Hammersley.
Joe Hammersley you weren't neutral about. No.
Nothing neutral about Joe. How did Joe, how did he get around? How did the police officer in those days get around?
I think he got around on a motorcycle.
That would sort of make sense. I could see him skiing.
I didn't put Harold Bradley on that list, did I? At the top,
no,
with the
didn't.
Bees.
No, you didn't.
Well, forget him right now.
Well, I'll write him down so we don't forget him.
Joe Bradley is one of his sons.
Joe Bradley.
The very, very, very much handicapped man.
Oh. I interviewed Charles Bradley just a while ago, one of his others.
Recently?
Yeah.
Where?
I'll turn this off. Go now to, proceeding on this list, to the next name, which is Dean Henry from the Ag College.
Well, I don't know Dean Henry, except that he was Dean of the Agricultural School, and John Henry Maul, I think, is named for him.
Mm-hmm. That's you never all had I'm... any personal...
No.
With him. What about Hocking?
Hocking? Mm-hmm. I know nothing about him, except that he went to Harvard. Before Turner did.
And you have, oh yes, he was the one who...
And Charles Homer Haskins.
Yes, you have him in parentheses with a question mark after his name.
Yes, Charles Homer Haskins. I wanted to check on the name, but it was correct. It is Charles Homer Haskins. He was formerly in the history department here.
Mm-hmm.
And went to Harvard.
And left here. And he was one
yes,
of the
left here. And was instrumental in... causing Professor Turner to leave.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he's the one who invited Turner out?
Yes, well, he's the one that was Haskins and Professor Turner's wife made Professor Turner leave here.
Mm.
I think he never would have left otherwise.
Yeah. His wife wanted to go back east, yeah. I think I remember.
Well, she wasn't from the east. She was from Chicago, Evanston.
And she just wanted to go?
She wanted to be at Harvard.
We have Professor Jastrow next.
Oh, yes, Joseph Jastrow. He was Jewish, lived on Langdon Street, near the bend in the road across the street from Professor Freeman. And he was either in psychology or philosophy, I can't tell you which, but a very, very strong member of the faculty.
I think he was psychology.
I think so too. And I heard on the radio Sunday morning, about a month and a half ago, in the CBS program that comes at 5:30 in the morning, Sunday mornings, a Robert Jastrow interviewed. And he is a professor at Dartmouth. And I am very strongly tempted to write and ask him, because I've never heard the name.
Yeah, it's not a common name.
Until, except since Professor Jastrow here, until the other day.
Well, certainly.
He was a very, very prominent member of the faculty and very highly thought of.
Collenberg.
Oh, Professor Collenberg. Lived right down at the end of the block on Kendall Avenue and Adams Avenue from where we lived, the corner of Kendall and Lathrop Street. The house is still there. He was from Two Rivers, Wisconsin, professor of chemistry, had a wife and three children, Herman, Eilhart, and Hester. Hester was my age, and Eilhart died of what was then called Hodgkin's disease. Herman survived and I think became a school principal at Two Rivers, Wisconsin.
Oh, went back to his father's original town.
Went back. Professor Collenberg, they were very interesting and colorful family, and they belonged to the University Heights Poetry Club, too.
Was he a poet, or was he just a member of the club?
Oh, he was no poet. No. He was a down-to-earth professor of chemistry.
What kind of person was he?
He was a German, of course, with the name Collenberg. Very opinionated, very much a ruler of his own family. What he said went. Everybody in the family, his wife and his three children. But the students always gave him a skyrocket when he came in to lecture.
Okay, a lot of people are going to hear, who are going to be listening to this tape over the years, are going to wonder what a skyrocket is. Why don't you tell us?
Oh, the people who were greatly loved by the students, a skyrocket, the students would say, sis, boom, ah, hooey, and then the what the man's name.
That was a term of endearment.
That was a term of great endearment and respect. Kiekhofer always produced a skyrocket. Yeah. Benny Snow always did. Collenberg did.
When did skyrockets go out of vogue, you know?
No, I can't tell you.
You know when they came into vogue?
No, but I think they haven't been for a great many years.
I know they were popular in the 20s and 30s.
Yes, but I think they quit just about then.
Probably around the war.
Yes.
So did Collenberg have any problem because of his German background?
During the First World War?
Right. He was not in the German department.
No, he was not in the German department, and I don't think he really suffered. It was the German department that suffered. I don't think Collenberg did.
Okay.
Have I got Leonard down there?
L-E-H-N-E-R? L-E-H-L-E-N-H-E-R.
L-E-N-H-E-R?
Yeah.
Well, he was also in the chemistry department. And so was Professor Hillier. But Professor Hillier and Professor Leonard didn't get on. And Professor Hillier was the one who was the original owner of 1811 Kendall Avenue. And they didn't get along, so Professor Hillier left and decided it would be pleasanter to grow peaches in Connecticut.
So he quit the university?
He quit and left the university.
Was it because of it?
He and Leonard were absolute enemies.
Was it?
Professor Hillier thought that Leonard did him in. I don't know anything about whether he did or not.
So it's politics, or the university politics.
Yes,
behind it all.
He just left.
Oh my, that's so I grew peaches in Connecticut.
You had a lovely peach orchard in Connecticut.
Did you know both of these men?
Oh, yes. Professor Leonard, the Leonards were not loved, and they lived on Summit Avenue at the top of the hill. You know where Summit Avenue is, right up here. There's, I think the house probably still there. The top of the hill, on the north side of Summit Avenue, very top. Great big house. And Mrs. Leonard was anything but agreeable, and they had a dog that chewed up my doll.
Thoroughly disagreeable family for time.
And she wasn't the least bit sympathetic.
So,
or I guess it was my sister's doll.
So it might be your theory that Leonard was the instigator.
I think Leonard was. Leonard had two sons. One, Sam Leonard, was a very brilliant chemist who was employed for years. I don't know whether he's still living or not. By DuPont in Wilmington, Delaware? Mm-hmm. Sam, and then there was George Leonard. No daughters.
What about Kahlenberg and the rest of the chemistry department? Was it
I think Kahlenberg got along fine.
Was the feud sort of between the Leonard and Hillier, was that sort of a personal thing?
That was a personal thing.
Where was the chemistry department located at that time? Do you know?
It used to be on University Avenue. Mm-hmm. Is it still there?
Well, they have the building now.
Well, that's where it was. Of University Avenue, I think, at the corner of Charter.
Mm-hmm. So, King.
Oh, Professor King. The great Professor King, who was an authority in soils. King Hall, isn't there a King Hall?
I think so, yeah.
Right up here? That used to be the dairy building where you went to buy butter and buttermilk and cheese. And it's up there. Babcock Hall, you see now, is where people get those things. But Professor King lived with his wife, who was never seen without crutches. There was a red frame house on the site where part of Babcock Hall now is, and the Kings lived there. They had, now I've got a picture of Clarence King that my brother took. Someday, you know, we're going to go have a session of pictures. Wonderful pictures. There was Max King, Clarence King, Howard King, Ralph King, Anna King, the only daughter who married a Mr. Ledbetter and went and spent the rest of her life in Rhinelander. And it seemed to me there was another one, another son. They were great friends of my brothers. I had two brothers, Philip and Harry, those four.
So there was quite a king.
Oh, there was a king, yes. And he was a very great man in his field. And he went to China. Now, you know, that's something, to go to China.
Do you have any idea approximately?
It must have been around 1905.
Oh, my.
You know, that's something. And I think that his book on soils is still highly respected.
So he was one of the leading...
He was the leading person in the College of Agriculture. Great man in this university.
What about Kirk?
And they were lovely people, too.
And a lot of them.
Yes. They were all Unitarians.
What about Kirk?
Kirk?
Yeah.
Oh, I'll tell you all about Grayson Kirk. Grayson Kirk came to Madison as professor of political science.
About when, you know?
Yes, I can tell you about when. Incidentally, my niece is married to Grayson Kirk's son.
Oh, okay.
Grayson Kirk came here probably, let's see, 1932. He was here in 1933.
Okay.
I know
that's close enough, yeah.
And stayed here not many years. Have I got the name of Carl Bogholt, B-O-G-H-O-L-T?
No, you don't.
We'll put it up there. He was from Amherst, too, Experimental College. And they were great friends of Grayson Kirk. He wasn't here many years. I would say probably maybe 5 or 6. And then went to Columbia, where he was president of Columbia for years. Now, you know, it's always been surprising to me because he wasn't so highly thought of when he was here. But of course, he was much younger, this is true. But he was president of Columbia for something like 20 years. And he had an only son, John, whose second wife is my sister Helen's daughter. And he lives, or they live with him in Bronxville, New York. His wife is in a nursing home in Ohio. And Grayson, John, his son John, and Eve, my niece, moved into with him in this enormous 18-room house. You see, when you're president of Columbia University, they had to do a lot of entertaining. And so it's a huge house. Well, Eve called me the other day on the telephone, and I said, "How's Grayson?" She said, "He's all right." I think she was happier before they moved in with him.
Why did he leave Madison?
I don't know why he left, whether he had a... I don't think he was called to be president right away. I don't know. But I don't know why. I don't think the Grayson Kirk ever fitted in here any more than the Franks did.
And why not?
In the first place, while they were here, they were not interested in making friends in the faculty. They sought out people in Maple Bluff. The rich business people. And Timothy Brown. Judge Timothy Brown. Well, Timothy Brown was a very nice man, very nice man. But I believe it was probably Grayson Kirk's wife. She was very ambitious socially and not interested in making friends with professors.
I'm hearing some parallels here between Mary Frank and Grayson Kirk's wife.
Yes, they were very much alike. Neither really fitted in, and neither wanted to be friends with the faculty.
So the Franks as well took their social circle was outside of the faculty circles, essentially. Mm-hmm.
If there was such a thing, as if they had any. The Kirks did have. They Kirks did have friends, or at least their social. Their invitations and dinner parties were not with faculty.
Which may explain why he later became president of Columbia.
Probably.
Who to cultivate.
Probably. Well, Eve sent me a picture of him and of his wife. All you have to do is to see that picture to see. Hmm. You can tell a lot from the face.
Yeah. What about his teaching here? Was he? Do you know anything about
him? I know only one person in Madison who studied under him, and she said he was marvelous. I don't know what John Goss thought. Because you see, the Gosses, who were friends of mine and belonged to the Friday lunch group, Jane Goss did, they left, you see, long, long time ago, the Gosses did. So I think their acquaintance with the Kirks was brief in point of years.
I'll have to look up and see what rank he was when he came and what rank he was when he left.
So yes.
He was promoted during his time.
Grayson
here.
Kirk. Very interesting. But he was no dummy.
No, obviously not. He did okay for himself after he left Madison. Okay, let's go to the next name. We're almost out of time, but I think we can probably cover Kerr.
Oh, Professor Kerr. He Professor was classics. Kerr. He was professor of Greek and Latin, and my brother studied under him. I think he became blind and was read to by a student.
Was he for here for a long time?
Yes, but I can't tell you much about him except much of anything. He was very early.
Okay.
Remember, I was a child when a lot of this took place, hardly more than a child.
What about Lathrop?
Professor Lathrop was in the English department, and of course Lathrop Hall is named for him, and he was very well thought of. That's all I can tell you.
Okay.
People liked him and liked his family.
What about
Have Larry? I got Frankenberger up there?
No, you don't. Why don't you talk about Frankenberger? Oh, you had him up, but you crossed him out.
Well, he was here. I didn't mean to cross him out. He was
Or maybe great, you just wrote over him.
Great friend of my father. In the English department, Frankenberger.
Right. Did he know William Ellery Leonard at all?
No, he preceded him.
No, he preceded him. Why did he leave?
He died.
Oh, he died. I guess you have to stop teaching yes. him to die.
Not like James Michener, who goes out forever.
James Michener, yeah. We had a little discussion about Michener when the microphone was off here and his... but can you briefly just tell how you know Michener? I think that's a very interesting story.
Yes.
We're just finishing up, so you may
How I happened to meet him. Philip, my brother Philip, used to come, of course, and make periodic visits to see Mother and me and Jill. And one day he arrived in Madison. Well, of course, we knew he was coming. I was living on Prospect Avenue then. And he said, now... I want you to get a bridge game tonight. Philip loved bridge. And I'm bringing James Michener with me. So there'll be you, meaning me, and Philip, and James Michener. And he said, I want you to find a fourth. Well, I found a fourth who was principal of the school I was teaching in. And I have never had a more awful evening in my life. I got the supper, we called it supper, but people don't use that word anymore. I still talk about supper. I don't think James Michener opened his mouth. The bridge game was simply terrible. He didn't speak a word. And I said when it was over, I said, Philip, what an ordeal. Why did you bring that man here? Well, he said he is getting a divorce, and he's going through a terrible time, and he doesn't talk. Well, I said, why didn't you tell me?